From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. A professor at North Carolina State University has investigated James Wilson's key role in development of the U.S. Constitution. You'll hear highlights from his research. There's a debate in Raleigh between the state treasurer and North Carolina hospitals. You'll learn why this debate surrounds future payments from the state health plan. Longtime conservative commentator William Kristol is heading to Davidson College in the fall. During a recent trip to Davidson, Kristol discussed key ethical issues in today's political landscape. Plus, she'll learn details of special elections scheduled in two North Carolina congressional districts. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Governor Roy Cooper is proposing to spend $25 billion in his new state operating budget plan for the year that begins July 1st. And despite the governor's frequent complaints about tax cuts that have been enacted by Republicans since 2011, his operating budget plan doesn't try to undo those tax cuts. Just a couple of the things happening in this document that would set the course for North Carolina. John Locke Foundation Senior Fellow Joe Coletti is studying the governor's plan. He joins us now to talk about some of the details. Joe, welcome back.
Glad to have a break from looking at the numbers.
Yes, walk into your office and your head is down looking at all the documents. Give us your overall reaction to what the governor has proposed.
First, it's not much different from his previous proposals in that there's no chance that the Republican legislature is going to approve something that's close to what he's doing in the major in major areas. The you mentioned $25 billion. That's 5.5% increase in spending over last year, which is well above what we've been looking at in terms of keeping spending constant per person, adjusting for inflation, and which is somewhere around 3-3.5% this year, and it's even further above what the legislature and what the state has been spending in has been increasing spending on since 2011. It's been growing at about 2.5%, and this more than doubles that increase. So that's a significant thing. And the other part of it is that, as you mentioned, despite all the complaints, the governor does not increase taxes, which is a little bit of a difference from the last 2 years. So that is a sign that the economy is doing really well, that they had some money left over the past 2 years. And part of that has been revenues coming in above expectations. You can't really count on that in the future, but that has left him with a billion-dollar cushion to start this year, that he's put half of that into reserves and has put half of that into one-time spending within the budget.
Let's talk about how he plans to use all of that funding. First of all, Medicaid expansion is in the plan. No big surprise there. Right. The governor is a staunch supporter of the idea of expanding Medicaid through the Affordable Care Act. So tell us what is in the budget. What will that cost? How will he do this?
Well, according to the governor in the budget document, this costs the state $0.
How's that possible?
They will add new taxes onto providers.
Would be like hospitals,
hospitals,
doctors,
and others. Yeah. The budget staff always refers to just hospitals, and so I don't know if that would be other providers as well. But specifically, hospitals have been mentioned. And then there's as Medicaid transitions from fee for service to managed care, the managed care organizations that are going to be in between step between the state and the individual on Medicaid, they're going to start paying an equivalent of a premiums tax. And some of that premium tax, if the state expands Medicaid, would then go back in to pay the state share of Medicaid. So
let's explain for a minute, too, about when we say Medicaid expansion. First of all, the Medicaid mm-hmm. program is a federal and state program mm-hmm. designed to provide health coverage for vulnerable populations, widows, low-income folks, disabled children.
Yeah.
And the governor's expansion plan would add about 500,000 people.
500,000 people to 2 million people currently on it. The largest portion of recipients right now are children, low-income children. The most expensive populations on it are people in long-term care, either the elderly or those with disabilities. And so that's who currently – and currently it's a 2-to-1 match for the state – federal dollars to state dollars. The new population, which will be mostly – able-bodied adults. The governor keeps talking about working adults, but you don't have to be working to be able to qualify. And so those new able-bodied adults will be covered at a 90% federal match, federal rate, 10% state, meaning hospitals, new taxes. And so on that side, if they're free, then that's a different set of things compared to the population that we've been trying to cover and will likely mean that there's going to be more emphasis placed on them because, well, they're free. Anything that we do there doesn't cost the state any money. And so that's part of the concern and shell game that's going on there, that governor's claimed often that he's not – that there are no new taxes and he's not raising taxes except for in this one place where it's a significant tax increase of 10% of $2 billion the first year, $200 million, 10% of $400 million – $4 billion the second year, $400 million. So that's a lot of money that we're asking the hospitals and these new insurance providers to step in. And
we know there's going to be a big debate going forward over that for sure. Now, something that's getting a lot of attention in the governor's proposed budget plan, Joe, is a very big bond that he is proposing. Tell us how much and what for.
So the governor is looking for $3.9 billion in borrowing, which if you remember in 2016, not that long ago, we passed, North Carolinians approved a $2 billion Connect NC bond. The governor is looking for $3.9 billion, what he's calling an Invest NC bond. And that would be $2 billion for public schools, $1 billion for universities and community colleges, and then another, and the remainder of that would be for local water sewer projects and for the State Zoo and the History Museum. But that's twice as much, more than twice as much, than what either the House in its bond proposal or the Senate in its pay-as-you-go plan are looking to spend. They've talked about $2 billion total, and the governor's looking at nearly $4 billion in borrowing.
Now, Joe, as you ticked off the different areas or entities that would receive that funding, should this actually make it to the ballot and voters approve that $3.9 billion bond, community colleges and universities didn't they just get a bunch of funding in the last bond?
They were a significant part of the Connect NC bond, which is one of the things that has a number of us scratching our heads.
Interesting. So that would be a case where voters would have to approve that. It would be on the ballot.
Right.
Voters have to vote yes or no. But you point out that in the governor's proposal for the budget, that there's also some debt that we could be incurring without a vote of the people.
Yeah, there's $288 million of what they call limited obligation bonds. There's all kinds of terms that the state has used for debt that's not been approved by the voters. And the largest portion of this is going to be to move the Department of Health and Human Services to Blue Ridge Road in Raleigh. And right now, the motor fleet is there, the state textbook warehouse is there, a few other buildings. It's across the street from the Museum of Art. But that's a place that during the McCrory administration, they were looking at and saying, this is valuable property. We should sell it. And instead, we're going to use $250 million or so of this non-voter-approved debt to move DHHS, the Department of Health and Human Services, there and relocate the other state agencies.
The governor has made a lot of the fact that he wants to spend a lot more money on the K-12 system and on teachers, and he actually wants to close the door on a private voucher system known as the Opportunity Scholarship, that for low-income families.
Yeah, and closing the scholarship opportunities for the future students really makes no sense. They say that it's because the scholarships have been used less than anticipated, but it's a new program. It takes some time, and you are really taking it away from the people who have the greatest need and whose schools have been failing them. So you're really making educational opportunity dependent on zip code and income.
Joe Coletti, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. He doesn't get as much attention as Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, or especially these days Alexander Hamilton, but James Wilson was one of our nation's important founders, and our next guest focuses attention on one of the most intriguing aspects of Wilson's thought. Dr. Jim Zink is associate professor in the School of Public and International Affairs at North Carolina State University. He recently addressed the John Locke Foundation's Shaftesbury Society on this theme, James Wilson and the Moral Psychology of American Constitutionalism. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So before we get into the moral psychology of American constitutionalism, first of all, why focus attention on this particular founder, James Wilson?
Well, because as you alluded to in the intro there, he was a really important guy in both the Revolutionary and especially the founding era. He, you know, was one of only six people to sign both the Declaration and the Constitution. He was instrumental at the Constitutional Convention. He was in shaping the language of the Constitution, instrumental at the Pennsylvania Ratification Convention, getting it ratified. And he was one of Washington's first appointees to the Supreme Court. And so historically, he's an important figure. But then he also offered or presented this series of law lectures at what is the current day University of Pennsylvania Law School. And it's this incredibly rich resource, this wide-ranging discussion of, you know, human nature, of constitutional theory, political theory, that gives you this incredible window into the American political and constitutional tradition as that tradition is beginning to coalesce and crystallize. So he's a really rich resource for understanding what American constitutionalism is all about.
So we know a little bit more now about who James Wilson is. What is it about his thought that you were particularly drawing attention to in this lecture?
Yeah, it's this moral psychological dimension, what I call moral psychological dimension, which has to do with his views on how a constitution and the institutions it establishes can operate more or less directly on individuals in a way that not only constrains sort of their vicious tendencies, but also reinforces those sort of other regarding aspects of human nature. And so it's his thoughts about how a constitution plays a serious role in citizencraft and help constituting a people worthy of being sovereign, to put it that way. So we tend to think, I think, of a constitution as a law that's interpreted and enforced by the courts, or sort of less commonly, but this is still the constitutionalist perspective out there, as the Constitution is establishing this sort of separation of powers and establishing these agonistic institutional arrangements. So an important part of our Constitution in sustaining the constitutional order is limiting government by setting up this competition among branches of government. In both of those perspectives, they emphasize different aspects of American constitutionalism, but they all focus on how a constitution acts on government. But what Wilson highlights is the view, and it's not just him, but it's really important to him in a way it's not for others, the view that a constitution also has this relationship and this effect with and an effect on the people. So that's what stuck out to me most in reading his works.
We are chatting with Dr. Jim Zink, associate professor at NC State University. That is kind of an interesting aspect of the Constitution, because I think you're right. Most people think of it as a legal document or something that stops the government from doing some things, allows the government to do other things, or protects our rights against the government. But Wilson, it sounds as if he actually looked at the Constitution as a way to help the people and help guide them toward a better way of acting.
Right. And so he signs on to all of that stuff about the Constitution as a supreme fundamental law, a constitution establishing the separation of powers and balances and checks and so on. But at the end of the day, he says the people are sovereign. And it doesn't matter how clever your institutional arrangements are, if the people are depraved, your constitutional order is not going to last. And so an important part of crafting a constitution is to recognize that it biases citizens. And if you have a good constitution, it biases them for the better. If you have a bad constitution, it makes the people worse. And so he is very cognizant of this, of how does this constitute – what kind of citizens will this constitution create? That was an important question for him. And so that's, you know, that's why I think he's interesting, really. But
what did he think about the Constitution that we ended up with in terms of that presentation? Did he say, yes, this is a good one that's going to lead to good citizens, or did he have concerns?
So he defended it vigorously. And as I mentioned, he was instrumental in getting it passed in Pennsylvania, despite the fact that it had many things that he didn't like about it. He was in favor of direct popular election of the president. He was in favor of proportional representation in both chambers of Congress, in favor of direct popular election of senators, where originally the senators were elected by state legislatures. He was a ardent believer in the sovereignty of the people and had a very expansive conception of popular government. And so if he had to criticize – he also was opposed to a Bill of Rights for various reasons. If he had to criticize the Constitution, it would be on the grounds that it wasn't popular enough. It didn't reflect sufficiently the sovereignty of the people. And that, again, is why he emphasized so much this idea of a Constitution organizing, politics in a way that creates good citizens and encourages good citizen habits.
Some people are going to be listening to us and saying, well, this is all kind of interesting, but what relevance does it have today? When you think of James Wilson and what he said about the Constitution, what should people today take away from it?
Yeah, that's always a good question. And I tend to back away from these questions because the tendency is to sort of transport people from, to think about in terms of take James Wilson of 1787 and bring him here today. I mean, James Wilson probably would have changed his mind if he lived all of this time. But I think generally, first of all, it's always important to try to understand the perspective from the founding era, because we often make claims in contemporary politics about what the Constitution is, what it means. And so it's always relevant for that purpose, to understand that there's this rich diversity. And it's important when we speak about the Constitution to understand that diversity. Now, what does he offer? I think he actually is good for contemporary debates about rights. His argument against including a Bill of Rights in important respects is relevant for contemporary debates about individual rights. We take these – there's a sense in which – the fact that a right is included in the Constitution becomes a trump card, right? And Wilson thought that that's exactly what was problematic about including a Bill of Rights. Wilson's case for the Federal Republic and about the importance of how it diversifies the citizenry is an important, always relevant conversation for past and present iterations of the debate over how much diversity can a republic sustain. So these are the kinds of questions that Wilson speaks to that never really go away.
In our very brief remaining time, does this idea of the Constitution as having an impact on the people and not just being a legal document, is that something we should still keep in mind and think about?
For sure. He emphasize the writtenness of the Constitution, documentary form of the Constitution, which is, an American innovation in, depending on how you define a written Constitution. But, I think it's an American innovation. And he thought that was a particularly important one because the Constitution serves as the touchstone for this comprehensive civic education.
Professor Jim Zink at the School of Public and International Affairs at North Carolina State University. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. State Treasurer Dale Falwell says the state health plan needs major changes. He wants a more transparent pricing system. It could save $300 million a year.
The unfunded liabilities of North Carolina with the pension and the health care are nearly nine times the state debt of North Carolina. On the health care side, that puts us at $30 billion. If you're interested in where $30 billion places you in the United States, according to Pew Research, it places you right behind the state of Illinois in terms of the severity of this problem. Now, no one wakes up thinking about unfunded liabilities and life expectancies and all these other issues. They wake up thinking about how we're going to best educate our kids, protect our citizens from crime, pave our roads, and all the other core functions of state government. But I can certify to you that unless we are able to take advantage of our largeness and give the state employees and the legislature the prices that it deserves in health care across the state, that money is going to be taken away for the next 20 years from things that you care about. Because every dollar that's spent on health care unnecessarily is a dollar that can never be spent on education, public safety, or public roads.
Not everyone is sold on Falwell's idea. Republican State Representative Josh Dobson.
I understand that our current path is unsustainable. Nobody debates that. I believe in transparency. I believe we should be as transparent as possible, but we still have to pay the bills. In addition, in my view, that is a completely separate problem from the cuts to providers that are currently being discussed. Many providers will not sign this 15% reduction contract, so they will no longer take state employee insurance. As a result, state employees will have to drive further and pay more for the same level of care, and that's unacceptable to me. Yes, I do worry about the catastrophic consequences to hospitals. I'm not talking about the big systems in the urban areas and talking points about high salaries. I can't speak for them. I don't come from that area. But I can speak for Valdez Hospital in Burke County, which will lose $7 million, or Appalachian Regional, not exactly a big conglomerate, which will lose $3 million, or McDowell Hospital, which will lose $600,000. We don't have that margin for error when you come from where I come from. Those hospitals are not just places to get care. They're part of the community and something we can be proud of, and we can't afford to lose that. So I hope we can have a comprehensive strategy. I hope we can work together and come and find common ground that does not have unintended consequences that this has the potential to have.
You've been listening to pros and cons of State Treasurer Dale Falwell's proposal to change the state health plan. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. William Crystal spent decades as one of the more vocal faces and voices of the American conservative movement. His role has changed in the era of Donald Trump. An especially vocal Trump critic, Crystal has lost favor with many conservatives, but he continues to speak out. Crystal will join Davidson College in the fall as visiting professor of ethics in society. During a recent speech at Davidson, he discussed ethical issues.
One of the biggest lessons for me of the Trump years is that we should be very grateful in America that we have limited government. That's kind of a conservative message, but I think a conservative message that's true, that the president has limited powers, that we have separation of powers. Doesn't always work as well as it might, but it still exists, especially with the courts and with Congress now that one, the other party controls at least one house. But also we have a federal system. State governments and local governments can do things. We have a huge private sector, civil society, universities and colleges, churches, lots of institutions which don't work for the government, which aren't controlled by the government. Maybe we should actually be more careful about making sure they're not, the purse strings aren't controlled by the government in some cases. For me, these last couple of years have been a real re-education in the wisdom of the founders in creating or laying the groundwork really for the creation of this incredibly robust, I think, set of institutions, private and public and nonprofit and secular and religious, and that make it harder for one person, if he's wrong about a bunch of issues or irresponsible or reckless or even demagogic, to really, you know, turn us into Venezuela or turn us into Hungary or really do damage to most of these institutions. Now, it's an interesting debate how much damage has been done and hasn't been done and how solid these institutions are and how much erosion we can afford. And that's an interesting, more, I suppose, of a political science kind of an historical question. But anyway, I've been very much sort of reminded of how grateful we should be to have this institutional structure. It's nothing nothing we did mostly. It's what our predecessors did. A lot of them didn't really get much credit for it, I suppose, but you now realize how grateful we should be for that.
Crystal says American leaders face significant ethics questions now.
There are a lot of questions about those who are custodians of our institutions, about their own ethical obligations. And I think those are not quite as easy as sometimes, you know, they're presented. And it's too easy to say, don't go out, you know, resist everything. And it's too easy to say, hey, just go on, business as usual. It's not really your business to get in the way or to change what you're doing. And I think it's also a further point that the leaders of institutions have maybe a special responsibility if the leaders of our most prominent institutions, like the presidency, aren't doing what they might be doing in terms of moral leadership. I remember after Charlottesville, I was on TV. It was a panel, I can't remember, CNN or MSNBC. And it was the very familiar discussion already by August of 2017 about, you know, why isn't the president condemning this? The president could do much more. The president's our national leader, our moral leader in times of crisis. I hope he'll step up, someone said. And I was getting a little exasperated. So I said, look, I don't believe he's going to step up. And I don't really even see the point of, at this point, I mean, it's fine to hope for it. But it's foolish for the rest of us to paralyze ourselves waiting for something to happen, which is unlikely to happen, would be my judgment. And I remember saying, I said, we have a governor of Virginia, we have a mayor of Charlottesville, we have senators and congressmen, we have pastors and rabbis and imams and priests in and around Charlottesville and in Virginia. We have civic leaders, we have business leaders, plenty of people can step up. Maybe none of them has the impact of the president, but that would make a big difference too. And I think it was actually, I later ran into Governor McAuliffe of Virginia, who weirdly was watching at this moment, or maybe someone told him about it or sent in the clip or something. And he said he would have done anything. I'm sure I didn't influence his behavior, but I think he appreciated, since he himself was speaking up, the notion that we don't look here in America to one person to sort of speak, you know, for the whole country.
That's William Crystal, conservative commentator and vocal critic of President Donald Trump. He was speaking recently at Davidson College. Crystal reminded his audience that the American founders did more than just set up the mechanics of a well-functioning government.
We have a system here the founders set up very intelligently. Checks and balances, faction, checking faction, separation of powers, free market where people compete. We don't rely too much on public-spiritedness or on personal virtue here in America. The founders are famously hard-headed. Some people even would say kind of cynical about, or certainly they looked around at history and decided that regimes that had excessive hopes that just people would behave well because they should behave well, those didn't last very long and were easily taken over or weakened. And we needed a more robust structure that dealt with human nature as it is, not human nature as we would wish it to be. Now, I think that is basically a correct understanding of the founders, certainly of Hamilton and Madison, the main authors of the Federalist Papers. But it's, in a way, it's become such a almost cliche that it's people have gone too far in that direction. And it is worth remembering that the founders also thought you do need some public-spirited citizens who watch out for the whole country, that not everything can just be, you know, ambition, counteracting ambition, and in a big country, factions will check factions, and in a free market, people will compete and you'll get the optimum outcome. They also thought some measure of public-spiritedness was necessary. I'll read actually a couple of sentences from Federalist 55. Since I'm here in a college, I feel I have to read some, you know, classical text, you know. Madison says in the end of Federalist 55, he's actually saying, they're discussing the Senate, the Congress, Senate, and the House. And Madison sort of walks through a series of possible things that could go wrong. And he says, yeah, at some point, if everyone behaves horribly, all these institutional checks that we've built in, 6-year terms for senators, the presidential veto, two bodies that will check each other, you know, representatives from different areas, some representatives from the states, some representing the people, all these checks which are supposed to kind of prevent things from going wrong. If people behave badly enough, of course, things could go wrong. But Madison says, as there is a degree of depravity in mankind which requires a certain degree of circumspection and distrust, so there are other qualities in human nature which justify a certain portion of esteem and confidence, Republican government presupposes the existence of these qualities in a higher degree than any other form. Were the pictures which have been drawn by the political jealousy of some among us faithful likenesses of the human character, the inference would be that there is not sufficient virtue among men for self-government, and that nothing less than the chains of despotism can restrain them from destroying and devouring one another. So Republican government presupposes the existence of these qualities of a certain degree of virtue in a higher degree than any other form. I think that's why it's so important to think about ethics, to really think about ethics in public life and in public service, not just assume that the kind of system kind of runs itself and no one has to pay attention to thinking about what's good for the whole country, for the whole people, for the future, not just for the present.
That's the voice of William Kristol, longtime conservative commentator but vocal critic of President Donald Trump. He delivered remarks recently at Davidson College. Kristol joins Davidson this fall as a visiting professor of ethics in society. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. North Carolinians in two congressional districts will vote in special elections this year, following, in one case, the death of a member of Congress, and in another case, a ruling from the State Board of Elections following ballot shenanigans in a race during the 2018 election. Now, Carolina Journal is keeping track of both of these races. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief, and he joins us now with the very latest. Rick, welcome back.
Thank you.
We are talking about the 9th and the 3rd congressional districts. Let's talk about the 9th first. Now, this is the district that spans from Charlotte East into southeastern North Carolina. Why a special election?
Because the Board of Elections never certified the 2018 election. And after a series of challenges and a series of state boards of election that were reconstituted and not, the currently constituted constitutional board has ordered a new election. Part of that at the request of the candidate who was leading on election night, Republican Mark Harris, and also part because of the result of a four-day hearing that the board had about evidence of ballot fraud in that district.
And in fact, the vote from the Board of Elections was unanimous,
yes.
Republicans and Democrats on that state board saying we've just got to essentially do this over.
Right.
So we also learned that the Republican, you mentioned, Mark Harris, who appeared to have won in November of 2018, is not going to be part of this race.
That's right. He cited health reasons and other concerns, and there were a number of analysts who said because of the information that came out during the course of the investigation, which was damaging to people he hired. He may not have had direct supervision over, but at least people he hired and some of the testimony that came out, he would have been very, very wounded as a candidate anyway. But he has also said that there's some health concerns that he had, and he's not going to seek the seat.
We also know that the Democrat who was in that race in 2018, Dan McCready, is going forward.
That is correct. And Dan McCready, in fact, from the time that late November when Dan McCready first decided that there or thought there might be another election because of some media reporting that was coming out, has already started raising money and has apparently raised somewhere in the high six figures for another race this year. And so he's going to be pretty well funded as he goes into there, and he's going to probably be ahead of – Democratic opponents and most likely Republicans who will be running in that seat as well.
Rick, do we know, based on the investigations, what actually went on that shouldn't have gone on? And do we also know, has that occurred potentially in either other election years or other races?
Right. What we know is that there was an operation that took place in which operatives, the one who was focused on here, McRae Dallas, essentially harvested ballots. What he did was put in absentee ballot requests for people when the ballots were delivered. People who worked for him went around the homes of the people who ordered the ballots and in some cases, possibly many cases, collected the ballots and turned them in, filled in seats for races that were not marked, put postage on them, falsified witness signatures. I mean, there's a number of issues of fraud, and Mr. Dallas has been operating since at least 2010, if not earlier. So this is something that's affected Bladen County in particular, but possibly Robeson County as well, for several years. And officials, if they may have known about it, didn't do anything. In some cases, the two candidates for sheriff in Bladen County were actually part of the, or at least alleged to be part of the knowledge, having knowledge of the scheme. So they, it's really a rotten situation there. And so it was something that, the state board almost had to act upon.
And presumably the investigations are continuing.
Oh, yes.
On this.
Yes, Wake County District Attorney Lauren Freeman is continuing her investigation. The feds are now involved, and Mr. Dallas has been arrested and indicted. Three of his accomplices, three of his associates have been indicted or arrested already as well.
What do we know about the timing of the redo on the election?
The election, the filing period for the elections is ongoing, but and is about to end. But what's going on right now is that we know that there's going to be a primary in the 9th and the 14th of May. And then if a second primary is needed, if no candidate gets more than 30% of the vote on either the Republican or Democratic side or Libertarian or Green or Constitution, all five parties are eligible to run here. If we don't have a 30% plurality in one of those races, then there will be a second primary on the 10th of September. If we have 30% or more in all of the party races, then the general election will take place September 10th. But if we have to have a second primary, that'll be the 10th of September, and then the general election, November 5th.
Okay, so let's move on then to the second special election that is going to occur. That is in the 3rd Congressional District, and that is in eastern North Carolina. And sadly, that's because of the death of Congressman Walter Jones.
Right. Walter Jones, who served for almost a quarter century in that congressional district, passed away from complications after falling and breaking his hip. And he also apparently had Lou Gehrig's disease, was in the early stages of that. And so passed away. The governor ordered the election to take place. And the dates for that, the primary is the 30th of April. Primary is April 30th. If there is a second primary, it would be July 9th. If there's not a second primary, it would take the general election would take place July 9th. If there is a second primary, the general election will take place September 10th. And the reason for that September 10th date in both the 3rd and the 9th is those are the dates that there will be municipal elections across North Carolina. And so in this way, the State Board of Elections will not have to prepare for additional special elections. It's going to truncate the timeline. It's probably going to make turnout higher than it would be otherwise. And so this is a way that you can save some costs of distribution of ballots and of informing election workers and things like that.
Rick, as if it's not already complicated enough, we've had some legal developments when it comes to the issue of voter ID, whether or not an identification will be required and legal in North Carolina. And that apparently will impact these two races we're talking about.
That's right. As of now, the State Court of Appeals has agreed to temporarily put a hold on this court order from a Wake County Superior Court judge who said that the constitutional amendment requiring the voter ID was unconstitutional. And that's subject for another segment. But nonetheless, if indeed voter ID is going to be required in North Carolina as quickly as possible, there's a very good chance that the General Assembly, is going to implement some sort of legislation to delay the finalization of all the rules and regulations until next year. And part of that has to do with the fact that we do have two federal elections on our ballot in this year, and chances of court challenges making sure everything complies with federal regulations, which are different than state regulations for voter ID, the General Assembly is likely just to try to kick this down to next year.
Rick, when it comes to voter ID, I mean, other states require identification. Why is this such a legal battle for North Carolina?
Well, in North Carolina, you have, for one thing, very litigious groups like the NAACP, which is just is suing at every opportunity. North Carolina also has been under the control of the Federal Voting Rights Act, and because of various issues, we're under a tougher level of scrutiny than other states than, like, say, Indiana, for instance, which has had voter ID requirements upheld by the courts. But the issue there is that they were not subject to extra scrutiny because of past actions of discrimination.
Well, these new special elections in the 3rd and 9th congressional districts. Of course, Carolina Journal will be reporting on the candidates, the issues going forward into those races. So you can find all of that at carolinajournal.com. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you, Donna.
That's all the time we have for the show this week. On behalf of Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.